And here we go, ladies and gentlemen. It is January the 20th, 2010, and you are listening to today's edition of the Ugly Truth Podcast, heard on this fine podcasting network, theuglytruth.podbean.com. I want to thank everybody for tuning in. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the program. We are off and running. Plenty of things to talk about, but we will wait until we bring up today's special guest to get into that. People ask me about the song that I use for the introduction to the program, ladies and gentlemen. That song is by the rock group Yes from their excellent album, Big Generator, and the title of the song is Love Will Find a Way. I tend to agree with that title. Love will find a way, along with truth and justice and all of the other things that we are fighting for on this program and in many other outlets. We've got to hold on to the truth, ladies and gentlemen, and we have got to impregnate the world with it. Because if we don't, we are all going to die a horrible death, drowning in a sea of lies. Because that is the thing that is killing us, ladies and gentlemen. Killing our country, killing our culture, is lies. Lies about the present, lies about the past, lies about the future. You know, it's not just enough to be good on issues of history, things that happened in the past. We've got to be able to deal effectively with the lies of the present and the lies of the future, because that is the currency that our enemy deals with, ladies and gentlemen. That is how they purchase all the power that they have acquired, is lies. Now, having wasted a good bit of precious oxygen with that, ladies and gentlemen, we have a very special guest with us today. Since we are on the topic of the truth, both past, present, and future, you know, having been a history major in college, ladies and gentlemen, I can tell you from experience that history is something that always must be reviewed. You know, there's never an issue that is 100% settled, you know, because there's always new information, new important information that is discovered, and then, you know, the brainiacs, the scientists, they get together and they talk about this new information, and they say, okay, how does this relate to what we already know about this? And a lot of this information, a lot of this, for lack of a better word, historical revisionism, leads us to very dramatic, very important conclusions that play a vital role in shaping the world that we live in. Today's guest, ladies and gentlemen, is Mark Weber, who heads what is known as the Institute for Historical Review. I would invite you to check out the website at ihr.org. And on it, you will find a buffet table of information dealing with not just the past, but the present and the future. This organization, the Institute for Historical Review, ladies and gentlemen, if it can be boiled down to one main ingredient that they deal with, it is the same topic that we deal with primarily on this program, which is Zionism, Israel, and for lack of a better word, better terminology, this thing known as Jewish power that plays such an important part in our lives today, not only as Americans, but as Westerners. Mr. Weber, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me on, Mark.
It's my pleasure, believe me. Mr. Weber, would you agree with me that what I said in the beginning of the program, that if we are to understand the world that we're in, and if we're to understand where this world is heading tomorrow, that we have to have an accurate grasp of the past?
Absolutely, because the only really good guide about patterns over time and the patterns we're going through now is the patterns in history, because human nature essentially does not change. That's why religious truths carry such weight, because they talk about the human condition and our relationship with each other that are timeless.
Mm-hmm.
Human beings in their essence, their motives, their hopes, their desires are the same throughout history. And that's why what America is going through today has some very, very fascinating parallels with the past, and it's very important to learn from that. The one thing I would quibble about is to use the term the ugly truth. I think truth is beautiful, and as you said, the truth is something that is in very short supply in America over the last 10, 15, 20 years, and it's a very good thing. Of course, there's the famous quote from the Bible, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free."
Mm-hmm.
And truth has a way over history of triumphing in the long end, even if people try to ignore it, because the truth can never be ignored forever. It mm-hmm. has a way of banging on the door until finally it gets in. And we're seeing, I think, more and more in our country the consequences of a policy based on deceit and deception for a long time that's having a harder and harder impact on our people and on the world.
And, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, and that's why, especially I think the work that you're doing, the work I think that we're doing, is all the more important. The one thing I would stress, though, is that viewing history is not just a matter of new information and so forth. How history is viewed in every society is a reflection of who has power in that society.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because our view of history is really a reflection of the interests of people in power. Mm-hmm. That's why one of the most dramatic changes in history that took place in recent years took place after the fall of communism in Eastern Europe. All the history books in Russia and Poland and Hungary and so forth were rewritten because the Communist Party and communist rulers were no longer in power.
Mm-hmm.
New people in power meant that history books were rewritten. And in our society, there's no question, I think, but that how we view the history, particularly of the Middle East, but so much of our other history is filtered through, for want of a better word, a kind of Jewish Zionist view of the past.
Mm-hmm.
And that has very badly distorted how we look at the past and, of course, how we look at the present. Because history isn't just a narrative of what happened. History is our view of ourself and our place in the world. And it's how a society views history is really a kind of view of itself, a snapshot of itself. Just as individuals, we see ourselves in terms of our childhood and our parents and our background and so forth, so also does a society's identity is also very much a reflection of its view of its past.
Absolutely. I can't think, I don't think that I've heard that put better than you just did. And I think it's something that is so, unfortunately, so seldomly discussed, which is that the way that a society deals with the past is a reflection of that society in general. And as we can see, with particularly with our disastrous foreign policy, and it's not just in the Middle East now, because for those of us who are paying close attention to this thing, this Middle Eastern policy in favor of one particular entity there, it's not just now reflecting itself in how we deal with the Muslim countries, but now you even have certain psychopaths within the power structure of the United States advocating taking an aggressive stance towards Russia, right? A nuclear-armed country. So it is not just, as I said, the policies of the Middle East. You know, we really are in a situation where the psychopaths have taken control of this ship of state, and they are absolutely, at least by appearances, absolutely intent upon taking this thing and running it into the ground, you know, in many ways as other empires and other political systems have gone in the past.
Right.
One of the things, just for the sake of posterity, Mark, the reason why I decided to name the program The Ugly Truth, you're right, the truth is beautiful. But it often weighs, and oftentimes, it's like a woman giving birth to a baby, you know. I mean, there's a lot of screaming and a lot of pain and a lot of torture. Of course, the end result is that a new baby is born, and of course, that is beautiful. But what the process that you have to go through to get to that point, it can be very ugly, it can be very uncomfortable. It's in many ways, you know, it's like cleaning out a wound with alcohol or methylate or some kind of very stringent antiseptic in the process of healing the body. It can be very painful, can be very ugly. But now, one of the things that I said at the beginning of the introduction here is that you and your organization deal primarily with this issue of Jewish power. And I think that this is very important. You talked about the way that news and information and history, the present and the past and the future, all of that, how it has to go through this filter of sorts. You know, the way that I see it, it's like these glasses that you wear, that you used to wear when you would go see a movie that was in 3D. And see, without these glasses, you know, you would not see a lot of what was going on. Now, conversely, we live in a system, both in the United States and throughout the West, really, where we have to wear these glasses. I call them rosin-colored glasses, not rose-colored glasses, but rather rosin-colored glasses, in that everything has to go through this filter of sorts that affects the picture that we see in such a way where the chosen people of God are always the victims, they're always the good guys, and anybody who goes up against them for whatever reason, they are automatically the bad guys. And therefore, it is our duty, as part of at least what used to be a Christian country and a Christian culture, it is our duty to throw all of the weight of our influence, both politics, economics, military, whatever, behind this vision of reality, this version of reality that these people have shaped for us. Now, a lot of people hearing something like this, they will automatically revert to one or two autonomic responses, the first of which, obviously, is for them to roll their eyes and to say, oh, that business. Or the second being the automatic charge of being a Nazi or a Jew hater or an anti-Semite. But you know what, Mark? My prediction is that the day is going to come when it's not just going to be a handful of people in this country who see these things the way that you and I and others see them. It is going to be the majority of the country. But what it is going to take to bring these people to that point where they are willing to face the ugly truth when it comes to this thing known as Jewish power, I shudder to think what it's going to take. I mean, after all, you know, we're involved now in three wars, right? We've got Iraq, we've got Afghanistan, we have Yemen. The people responsible for getting us involved in these wars, and no, I'm not talking about 19 Arab hijackers with box cutters, but rather this thing that we call the Israeli lobby, they're just getting warmed up, as the old saying goes. They've already made it clear that this is just the opening act of what is going to be a much larger drama to include Iran, Pakistan, any country that is on the hit list when it comes to Israel. So let me ask you this now. Are these people, I mean, are they truly as mad as their successful actions make them appear to be? It would seem to me that they are on this mad drive to destroy the United States by getting us bogged down in these wars and whatnot. What do you think the overall agenda of these people is, and are they going to succeed in the end?
Well, very well put. I can't disagree with any of the points you made. You made some very, very good points. I use the term Jewish Zionist power. Some people talk about the Israel lobby. Some talk about the Jewish lobby. But this power is a very real thing. I've said it many times. Probably you have, too. This doesn't mean that we hate people. It doesn't mean that I'm speaking for myself, I guess. I don't wish ill of any person or harmed any person based on his ancestry. But this thing, this Jewish power, Jewish Zionist power, however you want to name it, is a real factor in the world. And to ignore this is suicidal. It's crazy because right. It's a real force. And no one should allow the fear of being called an anti-Semite or a hater to be a reason to shut up about a factor that is this important. Now, when you say, well, yeah, how mad can this be? I'm afraid what it's based on is a kind of arrogance, an arrogance by this group, this cabal, this power, that they know best and that they can pull off this astonishing feat of turning the American people and the American society against its own best interests, mm-hmm. and instead push it for an interest that's an alien one, a different one.
Right.
Now, I'm very encouraged, though, that all around the world and increasingly across our country, there's a growing awareness about this power. And anyone who spends very much time overseas or following the media around the world can see the great contrast between, on the one hand, the American media and the American political life, and the political life and the media around the rest of the world. Now, it's not absolute, but it's certainly a big contrast, because the skewed nature of our foreign policy is largely reflection of the fact that nowhere is this power so well entrenched and so dominant as it is here in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm very encouraged. Around the world, there's a real consensus that Israel's policy and U.S. policy in support of Israel is not only wrong. Now, that's something that there's been a consensus around for a long time. The world, for example, regards Israel's occupation policy as illegal and wrong. There's a consensus around the world about that, and it's reflected in numerous votes in the United Nations, oftentimes in the Security Council. The United States and Israel and maybe the Marshall Islands are the only country to be on one side, and the whole rest of the world is on the other. But increasingly, and this is a reference to something you said earlier, increasingly countries around the world regard these policies by the U.S. and by Israel not only as wrong, but harmful to their interests.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that's because people may set aside their moral feelings and put their interests ahead, but increasingly there's a realization that this mad policy, as reflected in the attack against Iraq and the talk about an attack against Iran, are not only wrong, not only would they be bad in a moral sense, but they would be disastrous and bad for the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why increasingly the United States is coming up against opposition in this direction from all over the world, not just, of course, from Arab and Muslim countries, but from Russia and China and India and Turkey, Brazil, all around the world there's a sense of this.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an encouraging thing. And, in fact, it's an inevitable thing, because the U.S. alliance with Israel and Israel's agenda is as you say, it's a mad one. It's one that might be in Israel's interests or in Zionist interests, but it's against the interests of everyone else, and of course against authentic, real American interests.
Yes.
Unfortunately, we live in a country where the American people, I think more than perhaps any other country, simply take it for granted that our trajectory of our foreign policy, that our policies are basically good ones, that we're a good country, and so we don't really do bad things. Now, there's some historical reasons why Americans, I think, are more accepting and less critical than other countries. But nonetheless, there's this general tendency to think that if the United States goes to war, well, it's probably good because Americans fight for freedom. We're mm-hmm. a good country. We mm-hmm. don't do bad things.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in a way, it's kind of touching that there's this much faith and confidence in our leaders and so forth. But it's also dangerous, especially because Americans tend to give a blank check to policies that has very, very harmful consequences. It's mm-hmm. amazing to me that there isn't more outrage over George W. Bush and the disastrous and illegal war that he launched against Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
I've made a lot, I've talked a lot recently about a book I just recently read. It's not a new book, but it's called The Prosecution for Murder of George W. Bush, written by Vincent Bugliosi.
Right.
And he makes this compelling, I think, strong case. But what George Bush did was not just merely deceitful and harmful. It was a crime. Now, it's amazing that after he left office, that's the end of it. Nobody talks about even calling him to account for what he did.
Mm-hmm.
And as one writer put it, Tiger Woods has suffered more in his career for his extramarital affairs than George W. Bush did for subverting the U.S. Constitution,
mm-hmm.
for violating international law, and for launching a war that has cost thousands of American lives and tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of Iraqi lives. Absolutely amazing. And it's amazing to me that more liberals mm-hmm. aren't furious, much less conservatives who claim they care about the Constitution, but when it comes down to it, don't seem to care at all.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really a dangerous thing. And when we do not punish men like George W. Bush or Dick Cheney for what they did, if we just give them a pass, that means, in a way, that holding foreign leaders and executing them for doing things
mm-hmm.
That are illegal is a form of judicial murder.
Right.
Because a standard of justice must be applied equally or evenly if it's to be a fair one. Otherwise, it's really an unfair one.
Well,
anyway, so around the world, about what you're talking about, this trajectory, this direction of U.S. foreign policy with regard to the Middle East and our alliance with Israel, which is, I think, above all, a reflection of the grip that this power has in our society, is one that more and more people are aware of, and that's an encouraging thing.
Well, I would agree with you. More and more people are becoming aware of it. The thing that, and again, I don't want to be a wet blanket here and ruin the party for everybody, but I think that we have to be practical about our optimism. The problem is that, yes, people are waking up, but they're not waking up fast enough, in my opinion, to head off. You know, there is this thing known as terminal velocity, right? I mean, when an airplane, for example, is headed towards Earth, you know, there comes a point at which it's moving so fast that even if the pilot is able to regain control of the navigation instruments and whatnot, he won't be able to pull out of it. Okay. Now, my fear is that, okay, the pilot is coming to, he's, you know, whatever it was that caused him to lose his senses there, he's coming to, but the plane is in terminal velocity right now. It's at such a point that even with his best Herculean efforts, he's not going to be able to pull out of this nosedive. And as you know, you and I were talking about yesterday on the phone, even if today somehow Congress or a good number of them got enough gumption up that they actually cared enough about the Constitution and really just about their own sorry rear ends, that they said, forget it, we're cutting off this relationship with Israel. At this point, I don't think that we can pull out of the nosedive that we are in economically or that we are politically. I mean, we will never be able, as a nation, we will never be able to get rid of this albatross that is hanging around our neck with regards to Iraq, with regards to 9/11, or, you know, even when, and I use the word when, not if, when the news gets out that the United States government was up to its eyeballs in attacking a United States ship back during the Six-Day War known as the USS Liberty. I do believe that we have reached that point where even the most aggressive radiation therapy or chemotherapy or whatever is not going to be enough to destroy the cancer that has eaten us out from within.
Well, I don't disagree. An analogy I use is not with an airplane or a trajectory in that sense. I often use the analogy of a person who has a very severe addiction of one kind or another.
Mm-hmm.
When a society and when a human being faces a crisis, the normal first reaction both of a country, a society, and of an individual, is to try to do more emphatically what they're already used to doing. That is, if a person has an alcoholic does not, until they hit bottom, acknowledge that they have a real problem.
Right.
They just tell themselves that things are okay, and they just try to cope with it in the way they're used to doing. But both for a country and for an individual, people do not reassess their fundamental way of doing things until they really hit a real crisis. Mm-hmm. Now, an alcoholic, it's when the wife leaves, they lose their job and their home, or some really severe thing is happening. And that's, I think, perhaps a better analogy. Mm-hmm. And in our country, we're heading for a very, very big fall. And this is increasingly reflected in public opinion polls. The American people are very anxious. Unfortunately, they don't understand how we got into this mess. There's a huge tendency by liberals to blame the problems on George W. Bush or Rush Limbaugh or some people like that, and there's a tendency among conservatives to blame it on Barack Obama or Bill Clinton or liberals. But the problem is really much deeper than that. We've been on the wrong path for a long time, at least 50, 60 years. And that's very difficult for people psychologically to accept, because if people have been, and a nation has been on a wrong path for that long a time, it means really shaping up. It's like a person coming into the doctor, and he says, doctor, I'm having trouble walking and getting around very much. And the doctor says, well, how have you been living? Well, it's true that I smoke a pack of cigarettes a day, and I polish off a six-pack of beer every evening, and for lunch I have two double cheeseburgers, but I want to be strong and vigorous like I was when I was 22, mm-hmm. and I want you to make me like that.
Just don't tell me to stop smoking, stop drinking, stop eating like a pig.
Stop smoking and stop doing those things. And that's the situation in America. We have been on a bad, unhealthy diet and lifestyle mm-hmm. for a long time. Mm-hmm. And until and unless that changes, maybe it's going to make the analogy, until there's a heart attack or a stroke or something, mm-hmm. that people are going to change. At a meeting that you were at, one of the speakers where you and I met in person was Ramsey Clark, mm-hmm. and former U.S. Attorney General. And I was very pleased to speak with him afterwards, or during the course of the meeting, and I asked him for his view about all of this. He said the same thing, or essentially the same thing. It's going to need shock therapy for the American public. And that's true not only for a nation, as I said, also for an individual. Mm-hmm. When they lead a lifestyle and have been on a path that is as harmful as the one we've been on for a long time, it's only a real shock to the system that is going to get people to change. And that's unfortunately the situation in. Now, that's why the work that we're doing is important, and it may seem very hopeless at times, but to me, it's absolutely crucial that the work we're doing reach especially younger people, mm-hmm. the people who can and must be
absolutely.
Leaders in the future
yep.
when things come down, when mm-hmm. things really hit. And that's why, even though it may seem very, very difficult, and it's sometimes very discouraging, what we're doing, I think, is very important.
Well, I would agree with you, and for the simple reason, what else are we to do? Okay, I mean, to just sit down, it's like a woman, this is, I guess, analogy day, but it's like a woman, you know, there are 10 guys who are intent upon raping her. So is she supposed to just lay down and take it, or is she supposed to fight back with everything that she's got, even though, you know, her chances of getting out of the situation by fighting back are not that good? At least after the whole ordeal is over, she doesn't have to live with the fact for the rest of her life that she basically laid down and did nothing. I want to go back to what you were talking about before, though, about having that heart attack, okay? I tend to agree with you that the American people will eventually, they are going to say, boy, we really messed up with this one. See, the problem that I see, however, Mark, is that we're dealing with an entity here, and by that I'm talking about Israel and about Jewish power in general, that by its very nature, by its very inner constitution, is very irrational to the point where if their plans are going to fall short of what they envision, and we have to keep in mind that their plans are not simply to have this little slice of land on the eastern shores of the Mediterranean Sea. You know, they really are a messianic people. They are driven by this messianic idea that they were put on this earth to shape it in a certain way. And this isn't necessarily things that you or I or others who study this issue have come up with on our own. I mean, the leaders of this group, they have made it clear that they have got this messianic mission to reform the world and to kind of make it in their image, as it were. My fear is that when they see that their plans are not going to materialize as they envision. You know, think back to that movie Fatal Attraction with Michael Douglas and Glenn Close. You know, here's Glenn Close, this lonely woman who doesn't have anyone to take care of her, and she's infatuated with this handsome lawyer and everything, and she's got this vision of the two of them, you know, riding off into the sunset together and living happily ever after. And then in order to keep that vision alive, the possibility of that vision, you know, she resorts to these acts, for lack of a better word, these terrorist acts, right? I mean, she destroys his car, she boils the rabbit, and then she kidnaps his little kid. And then at the end, when all of these things have failed to keep him within her circle of influence, she shows up at the house with a big butcher knife. And that is what I fear that we are going to be facing with regards to Israel. I mean, if they were willing to go to the lengths of attacking a United States ship in 1967 and killing 34 men in what was uncontestably an act of war, if they were willing to have their hands up to their elbows in 9/11, why would we assume that they would not do something equally bad or even worse if it meant that the world that they envision is going to slip out of their grasp?
Right, yes. Well, that's all true. You know, I've cited many times, and you're probably familiar with it yourself, an article by Irving Kristol in Commentary Magazine several years ago, in which he talked about, at a minimum, he said, the United States should be transforming the regimes, and he named half a dozen countries that we should be going in and transforming their governments so that they're acceptable to Israel and acceptable to neoconservatives, Jewish.